All right, today is August 20th, 2004, and I'm with Kirill Svoboda. And where we had left off, I believe, is with you at Bell Labs, and we had done, I think, a rather quick overview of the research that you do, but I was hoping that you could go into it again, maybe at more length.
Right.
Again, what is sort of the evolution of your research at those labs?
Right. Well, so I went there after this summer course in Woods Hole, which was sort of an important piece of my neuroscience education. And yet, you know, I was still quite, I think, when I got there, still naive on some fronts in what the important questions in neuroscience are. Well, I had a good idea of what some of the important questions are, but of course, in neuroscience, in particular, one always has to think about questions that are also addressable in some way, that can be, that are tractable perhaps. And I think that is an important aspect of choosing a problem, is not just to be able to identify significant questions, but significant questions that are sort of amenable to currently available experimental approaches.
Right.
And so I started off trying to... So early on I got interested in synapses and how synapses could underlie learning and memory and stuff like that in the mammalian cortex. And so the idea I had was to distinguish myself or distinguish my... lots of people, of course, study synapses, but the thing that I wanted to do is study individual synapses, and which would teach me a lot about the basic biology of synapses. But I think that is absolutely essential to learning about the relationship between synapses and the properties of synapses and learning and memory, because there are lots of theoretical and all kinds of circumstantial data that suggests that the properties of individual synapses in some ways encode memories. And that's something that is very indirect and really begs to be tested and probed more directly. And so the idea was to use optical tools to study synapses as opposed to electrodes, which was sort of the classical way to, or let's say optical tools in addition to electrodes, because electrodes, when one records from a neuron by sort of almost, you know, that's part of its jobs, it integrates input from many synapses. And so if one records from a neuron, one averages over the response of multiple synapses. But with optical methods, one can really perhaps look at individual synapses. And there are several ways of doing that, and one idea in particular I wanted to pursue at Bell Labs, which was to essentially excite individual synapses using uncaging, and using in particular this two-photon excitation technique that we still use quite a bit for a variety of purposes, that essentially allows one to photorelease substances in a tiny focal volume on the order of a micron on the side.
Right.
And so essentially probe and stimulate a single synapse. For various reasons that didn't work, and those reasons are mostly technical, and I think I mentioned earlier, right now we're actually doing these experiments because some of the technical obstacles were overcome. In particular, now we have better caged compounds that are more amenable to two-photon excitation.
Mm-hmm.
But that experiment failed, and then Winfried Denk at Bell Labs had basically figured out that two-photon excitation was a great way to image in scattering tissues. And in particular, he had sort of started to look at calcium influx into individual synaptic compartments, and that it turns out is a different way to probe the function of single synapses, because there's the compartments that I became interested in are called dendritic spines, which are the receiving end of synapses. They're tiny cellular compartments, and there's one of these dendritic spines per synapse. And when the synapse is active, calcium comes in, but it's a very local calcium accumulation. One can then use that calcium elevation as a indication of synaptic function, mm-hmm. because it's the synaptic receptors that emit the calcium. And so that's one area of work that sort of began at Bell Labs, and that we're still pursuing today. In various, we've sort of used that in a variety of ways. We, for example, measured the properties of synaptic receptors. They again are inaccessible to other techniques, and we have learned a lot about calcium signaling. Calcium itself is also important, so we've used calcium to learn about receptors and synapses, but calcium by itself is an important variable in neurobiology because it couples the excitation or provided by synaptic transmission to biochemistry, because it drives biochemical reactions. So we've studied a lot of, this is actually mostly since I left Bell Labs, where we've gotten interested in calcium signaling per se. But at Bell Labs, the other thing that we did, a lot of playing around, sort of exploring what kinds of things were possible to do with these kinds of tools, and that was Bell Labs was a very good place to do that. I set up a couple of lasers, and they were played around with using these lasers for microscopy. Then another important experiment was to use a biophysical technique, important for me at least, was using biophysical techniques, something called fluorescence recovery after photo bleaching, to measure, in fact, to what extent dendritic spines are coupled to the rest of the neuron. So this is sort of an example of microphysiology, really trying to understand the subcompartmental arrangement of neurons and synapses and so on. And another, then we moved to the intact brain, and we, again, my interest was to ultimately to try to relate these essentially biophysical assays at the synapse to try to learn about the properties of synapses in the context of learning. Mm-hmm. And so in some way or another, these experiments had to be done in the intact animal. And again, the fact that these techniques allow imaging deep in the brain allowed us to do in vivo experiments. So that's what I spent probably half of my time at Bell Labs was done in vivo experiments. Also, lots of that stuff has been continued here. Mm-hmm. And so it was actually a relatively short postdoc, less than 3 years, considering I had changed fields. And so it was a bit, the projects that I worked on in some sense lack cohesion, but I certainly learned a lot and got exposed to several preparations and carried with me a lot of the big toolbox that I could apply to problems here.
Right.
And just historically, I think it's interesting that I lived through a couple of important changes at Bell Labs. Bell Labs had been this fantastic place and was still a fantastic place, but a little bit on decline. It was actually part of part of AT&T at that point. This was, of course, long after AT&T, after breakup of the Bell companies. And so now we're part of AT&T, but AT&T had turned into a service company. So mm-hmm. this sort of, this was all part of the physics research labs that traditionally had supported hardware development, chips and fiber optics, communications and so on. And so the atmosphere when I started off there was a bit there was an era of decline of the importance of the research labs and the support for the research labs, and there was considerable excitement when about halfway through AT&T split off Lucent Technologies and another company, and Lucent became essentially a hardware company and took most of the chunk of Bell Labs that I was part of with it. And now, of course, and that was, you know, a company that would make switches and fiber optic communications and so on. And there was a lot of excitement, and, you know, they were decimated, unfortunately, during the technology slump a couple of years ago. It really came at a terrible time for them, and there were a couple of bad management decisions. But so my time was really divided between AT&T and Lucent, and the latter part was actually the atmosphere improved considerably. Right. Before it got much worse, after I left. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So I don't think there's basic research there anymore.
Hmm. So you were there on the last great day, is sort of.
Pretty much. Yeah.
And what was, working under Dank and Tank, what were their lab management styles?
Well, they were. Well, they both have very small labs, and to some extent, it was me. And Tank was the department head, so he had some other responsibilities. One of his responsibilities was to argue and explain why this was a worthwhile pursuit for a phone company, and he was very effective at that. They were both hands-on, and Denk was really was in the laboratory constantly, so hands-on in the sense that he did a lot of experiments and constructed a lot of instrumentation. Tank had a slightly bigger operation, maybe two or three people, and he basically was mostly was turning his back on the kind of stuff that I was doing, and started working on other things. So I interacted with him less and less directly as I scientifically. I mean, he's around all the time and so on. But as I stayed on, and they were both very, intellectually very. Very sharp and broadly educated and very unlike, I think, typical department heads. It was fairly helter-skelter, the whole place, and well-supported. Of course, no grant writing, which was good. Mm-hmm. But there was a great sense of urgency always, and. Because the manpower was so short, right. And they had very clear ideas of what they wanted to do, what they wanted to accomplish, and were very efficient at getting it done. Again, because I think there was very little manpower, there was very little effort to waste.
Right.
So it was. I learned a lot also from that, and they. They were actually what looked like wasteful on the surface, because they had a lot of equipment. They had of many things that looked very expensive. One spare in case one broke, mm-hmm. and when you do the calculation, it turns out to actually be an efficient thing to do, because the downtime and the headaches you have. And people often don't do that calculation correctly. And those are the kinds of things I learned there that would have been difficult to learn somewhere else, where you really think about the cost-benefit analysis of where to spend your money, the research funds you have, and how to really propel science forward efficiently. Right. And they were very acutely aware of that. I'm not saying that people at universities aren't, but not universally so, I would say.
Right.
Yeah, and they were fairly fearless. That was another thing, that it was a place where really risk was rewarded, and where, you know, people were sort of trying to tackle relatively big questions. Again, that happens on occasion at universities. You know, the best people do that at universities, but they did that, you know, routinely at Bell Labs. It was sort of the culture there.
Mm-hmm. In 97, when you leave Bell Labs, I mean, why did you leave when you did? What went into?
Well, it's interesting. I had relatively early on a job offer here, and so as I mentioned earlier, I had some feelers about going to an applied physics department as a faculty member after grad school, and those guys at Cornell, they sort of kept in touch, and that's a very good place for applied physics. And it has this physics, it has this biophysics component. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I published a paper, and then they asked me to apply to a job, and I got a job offer there, and I was a bit. Oh, this was actually right. This is very, very early on. I had probably been at Bell Labs maybe 9 months.
So 94, maybe early
95. Yeah, okay. Perhaps. And I was, although I liked the place a lot, I was a bit reluctant to go back to where I'd been. Sort of not my style. And the other thing was that I really felt it would be better for me to be in a biology department, and that's where I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
But probably a biology department wouldn't give me a job as a neurobiologist at that time. It turns out I'd met Roberto Marino and Holly Klein, who are scientists here at Cold Spring Harbor, who had just moved to Cold Spring Harbor, which and during that summer course at Woods Hole. And these guys invited me to apply for a job here. And I don't know how that came about. Oh, I think what happened is I actually asked them for their advice. And I said, look, you know, I have this job. Do you think you can make do neuroscience there? And they said, well, look, you know, there are openings here. There will be openings here. Or there's perhaps some, or you would fit in well here. There actually wasn't a lab space, turns out. But that's a different story. But And they said, look, come over, give a talk. And here at Cold Spring Harbor, things can go very quickly. You know, there are no mm-hmm. FTEs or anything like that. Okay, so yeah. It really is, there's, you come and you talk to a few people, and then if support builds, it can happen very quickly, especially back then where there was a fair amount of slush money around. You know, the economy was good, private donors were giving, and so on. But so... So this was in 1995, perhaps late 95, and so I gave a talk here, and like weeks later, I had a job offer that mm. basically matched the very generous sort of startup packages you can get in a physics department, which mm-hmm. were unusual in biology departments then. That, together with the fact that I really liked the sort of the research institute atmosphere, and this place really did remind me a little bit of Bell Labs. There were some similarities with, and some of the disadvantages were in here. You could actually hire, you know, several people and run a normal biology lab, but you didn't have too many administrative loads. So, the conclusion of this long story is that I had a job offer relatively early on during my postdoc, and so I had to, at some point, leave to take that position. But the other thing is that I was also, that at Bell Labs, postdocs, those are physics postdocs, they're usually 2 years with 1 year renewable. And David wanted to hire someone else. He only had one slot, David Tank. And he really wanted to hire someone for his goldfish project. His interests had shifted. So he probably wouldn't have been too amenable to... These guys are not soft there. They were not soft, you know.
Brutal, right?
And
kick them out and get inside.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And you know, we were friends, and there was no hard feelings. But it was not, stay as long as you want, you know, the way I do it here, you know.
It's
especially with someone who is reasonably, at that point, very reasonably valuable, because they can run by themselves and help other people and so on.
But, right.
No, they needed that slot.
So you were homeless, or at least...
No, I wasn't homeless. I had this job here already for a year and a half, and so I just moved here.
Right.
I was lapless, in a sense, but that's... Yeah.
All right, so in other words, so they offered you a position in 95. You continued to work at Bell Labs.
Yeah.
So you just simply said, I'll be there.
Yeah,
and when
right.
97 came around,
exactly.
You started your own lab.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that wasn't that, I mean, you know, it was 1.5 years as opposed to, you know, 1 year is typical. So it wasn't...
too long of a period.
Yeah, it wasn't. No.
All right. What was, and you established your lab in 97, what was the startup package here?
Well, so I had sort of a list of stuff that you're talking about Cold Spring Harbor now, I presume.
And so I
had a list of stuff that I needed that I had put together for this other job. And I basically went to Bruce Stillman, who was the director then, and now his title is CEO and president, I think. There is this sort of title inflation, but he has the same job.
Right.
And he's the... There are no departments here. He really is has a lot of influence, or you can call it power, to be direct. And said, look, this is what I get from them. And he actually was reluctant to sign something like that or something, but he said, look, pretty much everyone who's come here in your position has been supported at a substantially larger level than that. You know, I don't like to, you know, I can sign this, but, you know, don't worry about it. And I talked to a few people that actually was generally the perception that especially young people are treated very well here.
Mm-hmm.
And so that turned out to be right. Now, I actually don't know how much of their money I spent. I have never calculated it, but this was also a time where, as I mentioned, there's a fair amount of private money, and, you know, I had done sort of fairly high-profile stuff, so I got a lot of these wonderful young investigator, a few of these young investigator awards, like the Pew, that were incredibly helpful. And then this was right when the NIH had, the federal government had committed itself to doubling the NIH budget over the next 7 years. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, the pay lines in NIH grants became 30th percentile or something like that,
mm-hmm.
which was, it made, R1 grants relatively easily available. And so very quickly I got an R1 grant. And so I never went back and checked how much of their money I spent, probably $500,000 or something.
Right, right.
I could have probably spent significantly more without them, without them complaining.
Right.
Yeah. Friends of mine here have. Mm-hmm. So.
Now, does Cold Spring Harbor Does it pick up your salary, or do you need to get salary out of
the the salary is done similar to most medical schools. So they so there's no tenure here, but we have these 5-year appointments of various types. Mm-hmm. And you they essentially guarantee you the salary for those appointments, yet you are requested to pick up to get your salary from grants. Mm-hmm. So most people do. So that's a big chunk of one R1 grant, and that is fairly standard. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there anything comparable to tenure here? I mean, let's say you're here for 10 years or 15 years.
Well, I've been here 7 years, and about half a year ago, I became what is called a rolling five. I got a rolling five appointment, so that's an annually renewed 5-year contract. Mm-hmm. So basically, at any time, you have 5 years to roll out, so to speak.
Right, right.
And there are people who are de facto tenured. They have endowments, but relatively few, and it's not the tradition. And it has simply to do with the fact that this is a place where only research matters. Now it's a little bit different with this new graduate school,
right,
where one needs some continuity, but I think this is there are 40 labs of modest size, and this cannot tolerate people who stop being interested in research and so on.
Right,
and so it's I can understand why the place is the way it is.
Right. So. And as you mentioned, Alpha Tape yesterday, the first graduating class actually came from here. I mean, actually was graduated this year. Mm-hmm. So it's been up and running for about 4 years.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, actually 5 years this week.
Oh, okay. Right. All right. You've mentioned the research you've done as a graduate student, as a postdoc. What are some of the projects that you have currently underway? What are you doing now?
Well, we have a fairly broad lab. We've sort of branched out in a number of things, but the focus is still neocortex, and you know, how do cortical circuits work, and how do cortical circuits rewire in response to experience, and there we're focusing really on synapses, which are the connections between neurons, and we work mostly in the barrel cortex. Again, that's a system that I started to play with at Bell Labs, and it's a wonderful system to study experience-dependent plasticity, because you can, this is the part of the cortex that processes information from the whiskers, and it, you know, just by making the animal do certain things through a subset of whiskers, or just trimming a subset of whiskers, the cortex rewires. There are changes in the wiring that happen. That can be picked up, that has been sort of described using electrophysiological experiments, but all of the cellular mechanisms and circuit mechanisms are really unknown. And there is lots of indication that these kinds of that what is happening in the barrel cortex is really quite intimately related to to the kinds of changes that underlie more cognitive forms of memory.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking at this from a number of standpoints. So first, in the sort of from the most reductionist standpoint, we're still learning about how these fundamental synapses in the cortex, these fundamental units of information processing, these synapses work in the neocortex. And then then another project in the lab that has grown in prominence is trying to figure out the structure of cortical circuits, how in fact what is the pattern of connectivity of different neuronal types in the barrel cortex, and which of these connections change in an experience-dependent manner. Now you're asking cell type A to cell type B, cell types B to cell type C, which connections change with experience. Then we try to look directly in the intact brain over in experiments that take many months, often the entire life of the animal. What changes when an animal has novel experiences? What changes at synapses, and how does that fit into the changes at the level of circuits?
Mm-hmm.
And then we are also developing tools of all kinds of, in a couple of ways, that allow us to analyze. So I think in the future, for future work, it will be important to read out the function of collections of neurons in the brain that are anatomically identified. And so we're thinking about ways to read out the function of populations, of ensembles of neurons. And that sort of technology development has to do with developing sensors, activity-dependent fluorescent molecules, and also targeting them to the proper cellular populations in the cortex. And another important aspect of understanding the cortex is try to be able to perturb the function of specific cell populations. There are these diverse cell types. We don't know what these different cell types do. And so what we'd like to do is to be able to manipulate these neurons in such a way that we can turn them off. So make genetically modified neuronal populations so that we can turn them off in vivo in a rapidly inducible and reversible manner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually something that's recently started to work very nicely. And those are sort of the broadly the areas that we're working in.
Okay.
The kinds of projects that are going on.
Yeah. Where do you see your lab maybe going in 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think that we've really just made over the last few years, last couple of years, I think some real for us breakthroughs in the kinds of things that we can do in experimental approaches and so on that we really want to exploit. So there'll be clearly defined sort of directions that will allow us to sort of harvest these efforts in development of technology. So we really want to understand what is stable and what is plastic at synapses in the adult brain. We'd like to understand the cell biology of synaptic plasticity in the adult brain in vivo. Okay, that is completely terra incognita, and we can do many of these things. So it involves, we know how to image, we know how to do the biophysical measurements in the brain. We have to just get the probes to the right place at the right time, and then, you know, talented postdocs can do experiments and discover new things. So those kinds of analyses will be, central to our work for a long time, I think for certainly 5 to 10 years. The new stuff is going to be to look at, rather than at synapses in this very myopic way, to actually look at ensembles of neurons, right? Ultimately, it's the patterns of activities in neurons that, in some sense, are most salient to information processing, and we'd like to be able to read out the firing of populations of neurons in the intact brain.
Mm-hmm.
So that will involve making these fancy reagents, but it will get us back to building microscopes, because we will need to be able to image faster in three dimensions, because right now with point scanning microscopes it's much too slow, and there are some ideas we have, but it's really very poorly formed right now.
Right.
But those are things that will happen over the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Faster imaging for sort of multi-unit optical recording in the intact brain.
Right. Now, do you see, as you know, the NIH has been pretty big on, at least recently, on translational, on what can be translated, maybe clinical uses of basic research. Do you see short or long-term applications for any of the work that you do?
Well, so we tend to not think about that when we think about starting a new project.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think that we are paid to some extent by the NIH, but I think that it's pretty clear that the NIH is committed to basic research and that's what we're good at. But the flip side is that I would be quite interested in working on neurodegenerative disease that I think is tractable in some sort of rational way. So where my kinds of contributions would in fact be able to contribute relatively directly to therapy. I haven't really found that model. We're playing with a couple of things. So we're, for example, very interested in Fragile X mental retardation. There's a good animal model. We've done some work that was, I think, fairly important, but we went through a phase where we didn't make much progress, and now we've come back to it using a new approach that we've developed in the lab, and it looks very promising. So we'll see how far we get. Again, trying to understand really the phenotype of Fragile X mental retardation protein, lack of Fragile X mental retardation protein on circuits. But it turns out that even though we don't design our projects with applications in mind, there often are. So for example, the kinds of long-term imaging experiments that we've done in vivo have been, now people are looking at using very similar techniques to look at the dynamics of plaques in models of Alzheimer's disease the dynamics of plaques with antibody therapy and stuff like that. This project that I mentioned to you, silencing of neurons in an inducible manner, there's a lot of interest from neurologists because of course silencing neurons is what deep brain stimulation does, and it's sort of relatively poorly controlled, right? So the alternative would be to infect neurons with the kinds of transgenes that we've developed and then give the patient a drug. In that case, you can sort of titrate. There's a dose response curve. You can titrate the effect. It's reversible and so on. And that really wasn't clear to us when we started in this. But now, last year, we've sort of told that it started working. We've told people about it, a number of people have expressed a lot of interest in it. Other or neurologists working on epilepsy, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually is happens remarkably often, relatively close sort of encounters between translational and clinical research and the kinds of things that we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, let's turn to the... Let's turn to the next part of the topic outline, which is more or less PI duties that you have. This is a research institute. You have your first graduating class, though. Do you have teaching duties?
Yeah, I've taught for the neuroscience course for a couple of years, which is really quite small commitment, about really a few weeks of mm-hmm. a couple of weeks of teaching. I've participated in committee meetings and things like that. I've also taught quite a bit in these summer courses that we have here. I mean, every year I give several lectures in a variety of courses on imaging, on channels, on development, actually. I mean, it's varied quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the teaching here is minimal. It's sort of comparable to most medical schools. You know, few lectures a year, essentially.
Right. So it doesn't take up too much time then.
It doesn't take too much time, and it's often related to one's research. So it's perhaps even even less than in medical school.
Okay. A question about travel, job-related travel. How much of it do you do on average during a year?
It's hard to say. It varies a bit, but I don't like traveling, so I travel as little as I can get away with. I'm probably away, I would guess, a month, a year, something like that.
Right.
Yeah, so I give maybe 10 seminars and 3 meetings, something like that.
Okay.
And so I, you know, there's a sort of minimal amount of travel that is necessary. I try to get, you know, sort of senior postdocs to go if at all possible. There are commitments I have. So, for example, the Pew meeting, and those tend to be very pleasurable, of course. But, you know, McKnight has a meeting. Hughes Institute that I'm part of has an annual meeting that one has to attend. And those often tend to be the best meetings. And then literally 3 or 4 other meetings where I try to attend as little as I can get away with.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very distracting. I rarely learn. You know, I've noticed that at many of these meetings, one only gets to hear already published work, which I find disappointing, frankly. And then often one, I actually think one could cancel 2/3 of the meetings without any loss of, you know, sort of flux of scientific information.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that a growing trend, that you're getting more and more published information at these conferences, or is that always?
Well, it's a good. Maybe this the stuff that I'm working on more than a growing trend. But sort of the closer you are to molecular biology, it's I think more the case. I think sort of in cloning. You know, 10 years ago, cloning of a gene was a big thing, right? And so, of course, you could easily be scooped. I'm only making this up. I really don't know if that's why that is so, but I imagine that could be the reason. And so you can easily get scooped, and so people rarely talked. And being second is completely worthless.
Right.
So it's different in physiology, but sort of molecular neurobiology and physiology are sort of merging. So these traditions from molecular neurobiology, I think, are taking over a bit, and that also meetings where physiology is discussed. However that may be, I perceive it more than I used to, and perhaps I read more than I used to, and hear more about published stuff, and I'm cognizant of it. So less and less is new to me at these meetings.
Right.
Perhaps I probably already have reviewed a good chunk of the papers that I presented. So
let me flip this over.